Last month, WNYC's Bob Henley reported that the Department of Homeland Security was moving to close the Environmental Measurements Laboratory in Manhattan. And since then, Congress has held hearings about the fate of this historic facility. It's a story that you heard first on WNYC, and joining me now is senior reporter Bob Henley. I'm pleased to welcome him to this week's Underreported. Hi, Bob.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
What exactly does the Environmental Measurements Laboratory do?
Well, I guess it's been around since 1947, right around the time of the Manhattan Project. And
connected to the Manhattan Project?
Yeah, it was kind of came out of that. Their idea was that they wanted to have, it was called the Medical Division of the Atomic Energy Agency. And the idea was to see what the human impact would be on people who worked around this industry. And they had some major breakthroughs historically. They were the folks that identified the inconvenient truth, to lift a phrase, that the atmospheric testing that had occurred open air in the west of the United States in the 50s had created a plume that came east. And their documentation of this resulted in the global consensus to take this stuff underground.
In other words, the weather patterns, wind patterns, were just bringing the stuff from Nevada to the
Utah,
northeast.
And it documented the fact that it was a particulate matter that was coming down and having an impact, a potential health impact on people here that resulted in working with the UN, a global consensus that this kind of atomic research had to be done underground. And then more recently, you may remember the Redding, the story around radon and the release that happened along Redding's Prong, a naturally occurring phenomenon, radon gas up through areas along the Redding's Prong, which is Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and New York. It was this laboratory that came up with the way that people could continue to live in their homes by developing the technology so that they could measure it and neutralize its impact on their living there. So it's distinguished itself historically.
Do we know how it collects its data?
Well, what it does is it has, most importantly, at one point it had about 120 scientists who are government public employees who are doing science in the public interest. And what they do is they had the technological base and know-how to collect information and interpret it. And also it was a multidisciplinary group of scientists who were doing this. And it was a tremendous resource. In fact, after 9/11, it was this public interest science group that provided New York City's police department with information on how to create handheld devices so they could determine if there was indeed a dirty bomb on patrol.
So it sounds like a really successful operation. Who was in charge of the laboratory before the Department of Homeland Security was
created?
Right,
it was that's a good point. There was a Department of Energy installation, and what happened was, as happened with so many government operations, in the rush to do something, and to look like we were doing something, which we wanted to do so badly after 9/11, Homeland Security subsumed many things like a huge cobra. And often in this huge sweep, it didn't understand the authentic nature of each one of the assets it had in its possession. And that seems to be what happened here.
So were there immediate changes made when the lab became part of the Department of Homeland Security?
What happened was this lab was under what's called the Science and Technology Directorate within Homeland Security. And Secretary Chertoff, when he came in, remember we had that false start with the governor of Pennsylvania, when Chertoff came in, he was open and honest the fact that it was very hard to find people who had the science background and the management background for the price of a government salary. Usually people at that level can make a fortune in the private sector. So there was a void of leadership at the top. So middle management people were making decisions who didn't necessarily have any background about what EML was. So you had people who came from laboratories that are quasi-public-private like Sandia or Lawrence Livermore, Pacific Northwest. And these are, they're government entities run by outfits like Lockheed Martin. They're coming into this kind of urban setting laboratory that doesn't have sweeping lawns, that's in a Barrack Street building above SOBs. And they're figuring, how can this be a place where science is going on?
It's near where we're going to be moving soon.
Indeed it is.
Is there a lot of radiation in the area?
Well, no, hopefully not, but we'll know it first.
Do they just put sensors on rooftops here to find out what's going on?
What they do is they put them all around Manhattan, and also they had a global footprint. This was amazing. Over the years, they'd gotten so much credibility. They had 100 remote relays around the world to detect background radiation, which is critical for proliferation. And in fact, oddly enough, the Bush administration was going to pull the plug on this particular program from EML just as they got an incredible agreement to put one of these monitors on the border with North Korea.
Wow. So you say that they were going to pull the plug. What did they, first they started firing people, didn't they?
Right. Well, they historically they had cut programs and staff, and then what they started doing is shifting these contracts. That's how it works. This agency with this lab would be contracted with by other governmental entities, and so these individuals who had, it's believed, alliances, middle managers had alliances with the more regular kind of laboratories like Pacific Northwest or whatever that do it, that are a kind of quasi-public, private, for-profit outfit, they would shift those contracts back to those outfits because their attitude was, it was almost ideological. You can't have public science. Why, it's much better if the private sector does it. We've seen this throughout the last few years of Republican rule.
But doesn't that raise the price of all of this? I'd heard that there were attempts to cut down on government budgets when the Department of Homeland Security took over.
Actually,
some of these things.
Good point. As a matter of fact, to save $10 million on the balance sheet for Homeland Security, it was pointed out by people that testified before Congressman Miller, and again, he was driving this train. He's a Columbia Law School grad from North Carolina. He's chairman of the Oversight Committee that looks into science and technology issues. He was pointing out he had first responders come from Washington State who had said, you know, when we need our Geiger counters checked and their technology for radiation detection, all that stuff has to be benchmarked by somebody. They sent it for free to EML, and it didn't cost anything. Now they had to send it out where it cost money to get it done.
So this lab was not just working with the federal government. It was also coordinating with state and local governments and,
exactly,
and law enforcement as well.
Right.
You would have thought that this would have been considered a great asset to a White House that has stated one of its basic goals of keeping the nation safe.
This is the disconnect between local conditions and national policy that we have seen from Katrina to Kansas. It's going to fight a war with a local National Guard, stripping away essential equipment for the traditional role of responding to natural disasters. I mean, it really is thematic, and it's throughout these last few years.
My guest is Bob Henley, who is a senior reporter here at WNYC and one of the people who broke the story of plans to close the Environmental Measurements Laboratory on Varick Street here in Manhattan. So was the city or the state consulted by DHS before they announced that they intended to close?
Well, announced. That's not how it happened, kind of in a bureaucratic backstabbing way, as these things so happen with emails. And it appears that the left hand deliberately didn't let the right hand know what was going on. And so as soon as the police department and as soon as the people that use this resource knew about it, they started organizing and trying to put forward the word that this was a critical resource. And then also something happened back in August. This position, the Undersecretary for Science and Technology, this critical directorate post, was filled by someone of stature finally. For a long time, they weren't able to get traction in the department. And they tapped, Chertoff tapped Admiral Cohen, who was head of naval research and from Greenwich Village, and someone who seemed to have a better understanding of what the lab was about. And so he has made a commitment to the House that they're going to turn this around, they're going to reinvest in the lab and even broaden its mission. We'll have to keep an eye on it.
So we can assume that the place isn't going to be closed. I gather that there were a lot of people who were upset. New York City officials have been trying to expand the lab's role in protecting the city from terrorist threats.
Right. And the thing about this, too, is that there's a kind of one of the things that Commissioner Kelly, that they have relied on is that there's, in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, all kinds of hucksters descended upon this city and other agencies like Mr. Haney selling all kinds of gadgets that'll do everything, the widget that will reduce all threats. And you have to have committed public interest scientists to vet that.
But as I understand the story, on the one hand, Chuck Schumer was told that no decision was made about closing the lab, but at the same time, the Department of Homeland Security had decided that it wanted to.
There was a little deception there. That was last year, and that's correct. He was given one signal, and meanwhile, the bureaucratic imperative was rolling forward.
At the same time that we've been told that there's a real threat from dirty bombs, and this would be the lab that would deal with that.
Exactly, and also has a kind of vested connection to this place. And that's what's really important. For the people at EML, it's not an abstraction. protecting New York is protecting their home.
What's happening now? Is the staff, is it being staffed by the same sort of people who were there before it was taken over by the Department of Homeland
Security?
There
is a legacy group of people that have stuck with it. There were some, they have lost some talent that it's unfortunate that people that took retirements because they were feeling frustrated. I'm sure people know what that's like to be in an institution and committed to and then see it get basically destroyed by bureaucratic intrigue. But now there does seem to be some hope. I have gotten some, there was some concern that in the last few months there's been too much busy work, like you've got PhDs monitoring computer screens as opposed to doing some of the innovative thinking that this lab is known for. But there does seem to be a level of optimism now that this increased visibility and support from the local first responder community has bought them another day.
And I assume the investigation by Congress and bringing this thing to light.
Critical. And as a matter of fact, there's no doubt that had the Science and Oversight Committee not weighed in now, nothing would have happened. And in fact, it would have just disappeared. And one day we would have, you know, not known about it, or it would have been too late. I mean, it would have just been a shame.
Do we have a sense that everyone on that committee supports keeping it open?
There is.
Is this a Republican-Democrat thing?
No, not at all. What was interesting is that some of the people that were close to the lab that came to us with information were pointing out that they had brought this very same set of circumstance and facts to the House Republican leadership and didn't get any daylight. Once there was a shift of leadership at the top, and of course it's for their partisan end, because this is one of the most classic examples of something that was a real potential disaster. I mean, I was surprised it didn't get picked up more here in New York. I guess we were still busy with IMUS.
At the hearings last week, Admiral Cohen said, "I'm committed to it, sir, but it does take time to change the culture of a lab." So he is kind of... he's having it both ways.
He is, but there's no doubt that to broaden its mission to include things like biological and chemical weapon preparedness, not a bad idea, and especially since they do have the faith and confidence of the first responder community here in the metro area.
How did you find out about this proposal to close the lab?
What's amazing to me, and I think it's the power of, and the honor and privilege of service in this job that we do, is that it was an anonymous phone call from somebody about 4 weeks ago and faxes that followed with the Homeland Security return number stripped off. Hmm. That's how it came. I'd like to tell you it was something else, but...
I'm assuming that those faxes also went to the New York Times, the New York Post, the Daily News, et cetera. Well, you don't know.
I don't know.
But
I know the Battery
assuming,
Park
but
City...
But we're the ones who told the story.
The Battery Park City broadsheet picked up our reporting, and the Washington Post.
The Washington Post before the New York Times?
Well, the Washington Post at least had somebody present inside the hearing that day and did what they needed to be done.
So are you telling me that there was a good chance that this place was going to be closed, but... the final upshot of it is now that it probably won't,
at least not
for the interim?
Well, I think exactly right. I think that's exactly the case. We'll have to keep an eye on it.
But I guess because it got a certain amount of attention and also because somebody must have realized somewhere that this was a valuable resource.
I think one of the things that happens when you have this kind of disconnect is that no one feels personally responsible for seeing to it that everybody who has a stake in it knows about it. And that's actually, oddly enough, one of the great resources about reporting on the radio. Once we get advised of something, we can move very quickly.
On the other hand, the Department of Homeland Security did cut back staffing at the lab. Do you think that staffing will be replaced again?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I'm waiting for the budget, and so is the Science and Technology Committee in the House, and they'll be looking at it very closely.
Now, we're going to have a change probably in the White House. Well, we're going to have a change in the White House no matter what, but probably a philosophical change, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican. But do you think that we're going to see more of this kind of privatization in the near future?
Oh, I think there's a much larger societal question about what's happened with the privatization of science and scientific inquiry. And one of the things in doing this story that was in order to develop a background on where this outfit was and what it did, I went and looked at all the symposiums it had done year after year on all this breakthrough science. And I came across this fabulous geographer who was, I guess he created the computer program that actually defines the city's a skyline, which is essential apparently for predicting a plume. So I got him on the phone and I said, how do you feel about the EML lab as a resource? He said, oh, it's critical. It's a great place. And I said, well, it looks like, you know, it's in threat of being closed. And he said, oh, my friend, you're very late to this chapter. This all started back when they privatized satellites during the Reagan administration. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, Elizabeth Dole decided that we would privatize satellites. And now that data was available only through commercial interests, and it became too expensive to access for public interest science. And then he said, worst of all, they just stopped collecting data on parts of the world they couldn't sell. So now, right now, we have holes in the data about the world, places that couldn't, you know, get a market.
On that happy note, I thank senior reporter Bob Henley of WNYC for talking about the latest development of privatization, the move to close the Environmental Measurements Laboratory in downtown Manhattan. For the moment, it looks like it's been stalled. We can only assume that that will be the situation in the near future, but who knows?
We'll be there to check it out. Thanks, Leonard.